we're here. Take it away.
Okay, thanks very much. Thanks very much for coming. What I'm presenting today is probably pretty intuitive to experienced field workers, at least in hindsight. But when I started out as an undergraduate more than 10 years ago, I just wish that somebody would have given me some advice on certain things concerning field work that I didn't even start thinking about until I was in the situation, which concerns mostly how to behave as a young woman in a West African society. And unfortunately, this discussion is not really part of our teaching curricula. And today I would like to make the case that we should be more aware of our gender roles in our home society and then also our fieldwork societies and think about making this part of our training curricula as well. So what I'm going to do today is first talk about why the fieldworker's gender is of importance, and then dissect gender as one social role amongst others and talk about what implications this has for our fieldwork. So one question to ask is, does gender at all impact our field work? And I want to make very clear, in many domains it doesn't. It doesn't make a difference whether I'm a man or a woman intellectually. It doesn't make a difference in the amount of work and the quality of the work that we do. But obviously it makes an impact socially on the community. So it has implications for our community relations. And that pertains, for instance, to what does the community expect of us in terms of our gender-related behavior. And that, again, has impacts on how the field worker can socialize with the community itself. In fact, it's very important for fitting into a community or, on the other hand, being alienated. And then, of course, if you feel alienated from your community, you feel miserable, so that's the contrary of well-being. And also, if you get into a community and you don't fit in, you might cause trouble to the community and the community might not feel good about having you as a field worker there. Looking at the literature on the field worker's gender is pretty unbalanced. On the one hand, it has been recognized as being important, especially by the anthropological literature in terms of methodological matters, so in terms of can I have access to cross-gender speakers, or are there any restrictions? But then anthropologists also talk about the field workers' well-being and state that mostly women are pretty vulnerable in the field, more than men usually. When we look into other disciplines like linguistics or physical geography is talking about this, it's pretty limited, especially in linguistics. There are some nice exceptions, but mostly if we talk about the field worker's gender, we think about what impact does it have on our research in terms of can I have access to all the speakers or are there restrictions. In general, we are somehow less concerned with the community relations as such or talking about the field worker's well-being. Now, let me take a little review in more detail about the different things that different disciplines say about the field worker's gender. So in anthropology, it has long been recognized that the personal identity, such as gender, age, and ethnicity, is very salient and affects the kind of work that you do, especially on the research. So Wex, for instance, states that there are certain rules on cross-gender interaction in the community, and they are based on gender and age. And Wex specifically says that she had a good experience as an older woman because she had access to the people she wanted to talk with, like mothers. And she also makes the point, it was not only the gender but also the age. Had she been a younger woman, the mothers would not have felt comfortable talking with her. And we get back to this intersection of different social roles in a moment. Then anthropological literature has also talked about the impact on the field worker, and mostly they have concentrated on sexual harassment and abuse. There is a recent quantitative study by Clancy et al. 2014, where they had a survey taken on field workers' experience, both men and women. And both men and women reported to have been sexually harassed and abused in the field, but surprise, surprise, the women were way more likely to get sexually harassed in the field than the men do. And then there are a few qualitative studies, like more case studies or anecdotal studies about female authors talking about their field experience, and in the end also making a point that we really need to talk about this in the training of our students. So in conclusion, the anthropological literature states that we have this lack of training, we need to train our students for that so that they are not totally shocked once they get into the field. But they also state that there is really a lack of institutional infrastructure. So Clancy and Al state that many women were harassed in the field, but they usually did not encounter any infrastructure or any rules, any policies in the universities that would help them out with that. And of course, it's complicated because often our field site is in a different country, and what if I'm getting harassed in Cameroon, what is my home institution going to do about it? It's complicated. But at the same time, Clancy gets also cited in Nature saying that we have to go through institutional review boards to protect our research subjects. We have to go through animal protocols to protect our animals, but we don't have to protect our researchers in the field. So we really need to start thinking about this. Of course, everything depends a little bit on the discipline you're working in, and different disciplines have different focus on different things that think and talk about. So I found in physical geography, people have very different issues they think about in terms of the field worker's gender. And that's basically getting women in the first place to do field work, because apparently in geography, very few women do this because it has this image of a masculinist endeavor. In linguistics, we don't have that problem. We have many women, and if we look, for instance, at the LSA annual report from 2015, women are now earning doctorates at a ratio of 6-4 to men. So we have generally many women in linguistics. It's harder to get statistics on how many women do field work, because we don't actually, I think, have statistics about how many linguists do field work in the first place, and then we don't know how many women do this. But just to get an idea, I looked at recent grammars published in the Mouton Grammar Library, and I was looking at the time between 2011 and early 2016, and at that point they had 67 grammars with 75 authors, 28 of which were female. So at that point, just for the grammar series, there are about 37% of female authors, and so the female field workers, at least. So what we see is that we have a diverse field of field workers, and just as we account, for instance, for different scenarios for consultant payment, I think we should also account for differences in our field worker population. Now, if we look at the linguistic literature, and how it talks about the implications of the field worker's gender. But generally, what we see in recent years is that we are more concerned about giving guidance to younger students. So we see this in a wealth of field guides that have come out in the recent years. But most of them don't explicitly discuss gender issues, with a nice exception of the Handbook of Descriptive Linguistic Fieldwork. They have more than a page dedicated to this. Again, it's mostly about talking, how do you get speaker access? Does the society have cross-gender regulations? And then Monica McCauley generally talks about the field worker's psychological well-being, but it's not specific to gender. It's just general training, how to face the realities of field work. Since it seems to have quite some impact, it's somehow surprising maybe that we talk so little about it, and I was wondering why that could be, and I just came up with a non-exhaustive list of reasons. So I think it's, first off, it's a sensitive issue, and it's hard to talk about it sometimes. When I talk with other field workers, especially female ones, I often hear pretty horrible stories, or stories where people feel very uncomfortable, and of course it's hard to talk about it. At the same time, it's not easy. It's a complex issue, and it depends highly on the field worker, it depends on the field work location. And generally, maybe we underestimate the gender impact to a certain degree because we are so focused on doing linguistics and doing other things that we maybe forget about the social role that we have in the society. I was also thinking that maybe there is a kind of pseudo-emancipation. We try to pretend so hard that we are all the same because, we want to have the same recognition in academia. And sometimes maybe that blurs the lines between academic achievements and having different experiences in the field. Then, of course, we have our research culture, which encourages us to publish research papers and not so much papers about our personal anecdotes from the field. And, of course, people who might have the most difficult experiences in the field are maybe grad students, because they are pretty inexperienced and they spend a long time, relatively speaking, in the field, maybe more than a full professor who just doesn't have the time to spend that much time in the field anymore. So at that point, maybe you also don't feel comfortable writing about this. Anyway, even though we have relatively little talk about this, I think we should be thinking about this and ask very basic questions of how does the field worker's gender affect their research, but also their personal experience in the community. And in order to do that, I think we need to think a little bit about what does it mean to have a certain gender and view gender as one of many social roles. As Butler states, gender is performative. It's not just about having a biological sex of man or woman, but it's really, as she says, members of a society imitate a culturally constructed ideal of what gender is. So I enact being a woman by shaving my legs and wearing skirts, just what women do. And of course, I'm not claiming that there's just one category woman. It's not a unified group, but there are things that our society, what we learn, what women do. We like pink. If you look at children's books or try to find something for your young daughter that is not pink, it's pretty hard. And at the same time, gender as a social role also changes over time. It is different to be a young woman of 20 years or 50 years. It makes a difference. One thing about gender is also that we cannot view it in isolation. It's not as easy as to say you're a female or you're a male field worker. We have this intersection with other social roles such as age, social status, am I married, do I have children? And in many societies, that's a very big point, am I married or do I have children? My profession, my economic status, ethnicity, sexuality, and probably many more social roles. The sum of all these social roles defines a person's identity. So I'm a white, female, mother, wife, professor, and many things more. And it's basically determined by people's behaviors, the way they try to enact these different social roles. And each social role is related to power. When I think about this, for instance, in my field work background from Africa, I can easily view this on a scale from the low level of power, and social roles would fall under it like young, female, poor, maybe jobless, unmarried, no children. This is really low on the hierarchy. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have the male, old but able-bodied, wealthy, high prestige, married men with many kids who are called the big men. And thinking about this, this is actually not so far away from what we find probably generally across cultures, just with different weight on the different social roles. So I think it still applies also to Western societies. Maybe we have a little bit less of an emphasis on unmarried and no children, which is a bigger deal in West African societies. Now, to sum this up and get back to the questions that I asked at the beginning, they're actually pretty it's not so easy to answer them, because as we see, it's complicated. On the one hand, gender as a social role is constructed differently in different societies. And also, we cannot view it in isolation. So every field worker is different, has a different age, has a different combination of social roles. So you cannot just give one answer to it all. But I still think that we can approach this and learn from the generalizations about this and think about it basically as that, well, usually when you go into a different society, well, you have your social roles that you bring from your home institution. But then the ones that you are expected to have in the society you enter, they're probably different. And so the field worker really faces a dilemma. On the one hand, you want to maintain your identity. You are who you are from your socialization. But at the same time, you want to fit into the community and meet at least some expectations to your gender or other social roles. And there are lots of personal choices that you can make. So, for instance, how do I want to enact my gender? Do I dress the way the women dress locally? Do I want to dress differently? Can I smoke or can I not smoke? Like, just whatever applies locally. It's very much a question about self-presentation. And I think as a young student, you are not so aware about this. And I think you also want to tell people more about what you think is right. And you're very naive in many respects. And then, of course, there are things that are beyond the field worker's control, like field work itself often might create an awkward situation, because it puts you into the situation where you do things that women usually don't do, like traveling alone, spending time away from their husbands for a long time, interacting with people usually you wouldn't interact with. And of course, you can't change the local standards of behavior. You cannot tell people, well, but the way you treat women is wrong. This is just not something that you can or should do. So you have to think about how to fit in. And again, women field workers are generally more vulnerable and prone to harassment than men are. But at the same time, it's not excluded that men are also being harassed. What does this mean now? What kind of implications do we have first for our research? Well, this has been stated quite a lot in the literature, that field workers may face restrictions in terms of whom they can talk to. So you may face exclusion to certain social groups, men or women, but also exclusion of certain topics. Like, I cannot, well, I think a male field worker would have a hard time to ask women about contraception. In many societies, it's just very awkward. And just as a little side note, I think often, even though women are more vulnerable, there are also lots of benefits of being a woman field worker. At least in Cameroonian societies, I always felt very lucky in my position, so I feel that I have an easier access to both men and women. Of course, I'm not viewed as a competition by other men, so I can easily sit in the kitchen with women, but I can also go hunting with the men and they don't bother about it. So I have more easily access to a broader range of topics, and for some reason men also feel comfortable speaking about sexuality with me. Thinking about working out solutions, there are many solutions that have been proposed, how you can work around restrictions, cross-gender restrictions. So for instance, you could work in mixed teams if that's permissible in your grant. You can work in public spaces and have other people see what you're doing so that you're not so to avoid gossip or jealousy, as it would be probably in African societies. And also, as Claire Bowen suggests, you could have speakers just record themselves if they could do that. Then, of course, there are implications for safety. And as I mentioned many times before, young women are most vulnerable. And the risk of sexual harassment is really real. It depends a little bit on how you personally feel about things and how touchy you are in certain situations, but at the same time, I mean, if it gets to a certain point, then there's no question about touchy or not touchy, then it's just very complicated. And again, it's not just being a woman that you are at risk, but it also depends on the interaction with other social roles and your status in the community. Do you have like relatives in the community? Are you a complete outsider? And also, it depends generally about the assumptions about sexuality and courting behavior that you need to know in the society in order to work your way around this. So when I talk about my own safety experiences, I faced lots of obstacles and issues. We got ambushed, I was bitten by snakes, I had a bus accident, I had a motorbike accident with my colleague Emmanuel, but never were my safety issues related to gender, fortunately. At the same time, I would say if you look at certain definitions of harassment, I would say yes, I did get harassed, so from catcalls to very explicit offers. But it was way easier for me later, once I figured out certain assumptions about sexuality, to deal with that. So in Cameroon, what I learned over the years, at least that's from my understanding, is that first, changing your sexual partners often and having casual affairs is very normal. Having sex often is important for health of men. That's what some men tell me. Persistence in courting is a sign of seriousness. So I would get very upset about when I say no and people don't accept my no. Why don't they take me seriously? Until later I learned, well, actually they're just trying to be polite and tell me I'm really serious about you. So when you know that, you can be way more relaxed about this. Of course, having sex with a white woman seems to be highly desirable, and communicating sexual intentions openly is also very common. So at some point you're not that shocked about open wording anymore. And despite the higher risk for harassment for women field workers, there are also other social roles that interact that might give you some protection. So for instance, in African societies, again, if you're a guest, you have a protected status because it's a shame for the host if anything happens to you. If you're well accepted in the community, you're also pretty well protected. And again, me as a white woman, I have these other power-related social roles that also protect me. I think if I was a Cameroonian woman of the same, well, everything else, every other social role being the same, but switching my ethnicity, I would be less protected. My whiteness protects me to some degree. And then, of course, there's a mismatch of gender role expectations. I don't behave like a Cameroonian woman, so I kind of fall outside of all these social concepts and categorizations, and I'm being weird, so that also protects me a little bit. Working out solutions about safety and sexual harassment, well, I would generally say, don't panic, relax, but just be aware. So the way I took it was that I would usually joke about this and just diffuse the tension, but that might not be applicable in other situations. Of course, you can always invoke a boyfriend or a husband. You have to watch how you dress. Withdrawal and avoidance is something probably that you could do. Being in the company of a local male or female friend, whatever works best, helps. And also knowing your spatial restrictions. They're just places at certain times where you just don't go to. And then finally, turning to the training of students, I think it's important to discuss this for the safety of the students, to better get them integrated into their field society. They should really avoid some cultural pitfalls and misunderstandings, think about their limits, basically everything that I brought up. And ultimately, that should make their field work more of a success and make their work better. So while there are many good reasons to train students, the way how to train them is a different question again, because every field site is different, every field worker is different, and there are just no universal codes of conduct. But I think a first step would really be to raise awareness and discussion of this, and maybe in the long term it would be desirable to have field-specific guides for West Africa, for the Amazon, or whatever is applicable. And also talk more about institutional infrastructures for gender issues in field work and science. And then just as a general advice, I would say try to prepare as much for the society you enter. Don't think only about, oh, I need to figure out these linguistic structures, but also think about how you enact certain social roles and what you think might be expected of you when you enter the field society. And that, of course, includes that you're somewhat aware of your social roles that you have in your home institution, which is less obvious because you enact something that you never think about. Also expect some unwanted behavior. This is not something that I did, and then you're very surprised once it happens. But if you anticipate that sometimes people might behave in a way that you don't understand or that feels weird to you, there's no reason at first to get upset. And I think this is really a big take-home point for me, looking back, that I should just not be upset about people. I just should try to understand why they do this and generally assume that people are not trying to be mean with you. So be prepared, but don't be overly worried, and just enjoy the benefits that definitely come also with your social roles that you have. Thanks very much.
We have plenty of time for questions.
Thank you very much for this talk. I think I share a lot of your experiences, and it's good to hear it discussed, because you're right, it doesn't get talked about much. And I was wondering what your recommendations might be on the home institution end, right? You mentioned that there aren't a lot of structures in place for assisting people who experience harassment or difficulty in the field based on their gender. And if you were, let's say, the dean of the University of Rochester, what sort of structures could you envision putting into place to help field researchers deal with that once they're home?
At least I would think maybe somebody to talk to, and it depends probably on the bad. I don't feel like I need to talk with anybody. I don't feel traumatized. But I mean, especially when you look into the anthropological literature, rape does happen. So I think it should get reported. And of course, there can't be any sanctioning if things get outside of the university. It's very complicated. But at least to have a reporting system and just something that researchers feel they can fall back on and have somebody to talk about. I think that would be at least the minimum. And then, yeah, it's definitely complicated.
I just wanted to add on to that, that my university, UC Berkeley, the female grad students who do field work have organized a group specifically to talk about gender. Mm-hmm. And also on a lower level.
Mm-hmm. Do they meet regularly, or what?
This semester, so I think the idea is to meet like once a month and maybe kind of share literature and have thematic discussions.
Mm-hmm. Nice. So actually, When I started out thinking about this topic, it was not that I thought we need to do this, but I actually got invited to a roundtable to talk about women in fieldwork, and that's when I started looking into this and discovered that the literature is really unbalanced, and it's really, I think it's good to just start the discussion because there's really not that much out there.
Incredibly helpful to talk to older scholars, both men and women, about what was going to be appropriate for me in the field, which I hadn't a clue, mm-hmm. hadn't thought about it at all, that I had to wear skirts. And I hadn't thought about that at all. I thought, of course it's modest to wear long trousers. No, I want to wear skirts. And not to make as much eye contact as I'm used to. And things that I would have never thought about, because I was so into the linguistics of what I was going to do, and that was incredibly helpful, just mm-hmm. to have older mentors say something mm-hmm. about it.
Yes, that's a very good point.
Kind of building off of the eye contact thing, that was something that I ran into working with the people that I work with, is that men don't make eye contact with women, but women make eye contact with women, which is fairly common across some cultures. But it was something that I hadn't really come in to expect, and there was no research for me to even anticipate that. So, you know, I think it's kind of just like that. I don't know, like when you work with people who are going into the field or that kind of thing, like how do you prepare someone who's going in as a linguist, not really going in as an anthropologist or something, to even know that that's an option, right? Like to be like, why is he not looking at me? I don't know like how would I prepare my students in a way that, like, rather than having an entire like here's a culture 101 kind of thing, but to talk about those options that
And of course, you may have students, multiple students who go into different field sites, and of course, as their advisor, it's a completely unrealistic that you would know about each of those societies. But then again, I think connecting with people who know the field site is definitely a good way to go, because as you say, there are just so many things that you wouldn't even think about. Why is wearing skirts or not making eye contact even a thing? That those are just things that even in anthropological literature probably has not been described, because there are so many particular things that you need to pay attention to, that there is just, it's not only reading up because there's not that much to read on many of these issues.
I mean, this is kind of coming off of that, but I mean, I think what we can do is at least sort of train people. I mean, because also someone might be going somewhere where no one's ever been before, right? I mean, this still happens sometimes. And not no one, obviously the people are there who live there, but no researchers haven't been there. But you can sort of, principles like, for example, spend some time observing the people around you, look at what the women are wearing. Right, and so, I mean, that was the advice that I got from, I went to somewhere where sort of researchers had been, and they were just like, you know, you might make mistakes at the beginning, they'll, you know, be grateful, but also just pay attention, look at what the women are wearing, see if you can at least start to know someone who you can feel comfortable asking once you get there. So I think training them in sort of observing or being sensitive to just this general concept that, yeah, you know, like, these things can all vary around the world. And
of course, you're going to make mistakes and you learn.
Yeah.
And I think especially at the beginning, people are pretty forgiving. Maybe something that is helpful is to have kind of a list of categories of questions to ask yourself. How do I dress? How am I being polite in terms of gestures? I mean, going to India, not facing people with the sole of your foot. I mean, who would guess this? This is not something that you would find in Western culture, but you really need to know that in order not to offend people.
Oh. I was going to add that, so I was at the first two Colangs when they were in fields, and there are several courses that were basically people sitting around like this talking about how you live as a field worker in cultures and really dealing with that side, which, as you say, often is not really covered. But I haven't been to the past few Colangs, but looking at the schedules, it looks like that piece has sort of fallen off. And one concrete thing we could all do is, for the next COLANG, make sure that we have, that there is something like that on the curriculum. And I think it should probably be a permanent piece of that. Of course, that doesn't reach nearly all the people that we would want to reach, but I think it's a big deal, because it's part of a larger issue about how you go live in a sometimes very isolated another culture that's not your own, where you don't have people to turn to for anything, and all kinds of embarrassments, harassments can occur.
Yes.
I'm curious, just how, because you mentioned potentially like slavery or sexual assault counseling when you get back, how would you beforehand explain to people like there's cultural differences and there's gender differences, and that's true, and people have different ideas of levels of sexuality and stuff, and that's fine, but how would you explain that fine line between there's different ideas of sexuality and I guess just deal with being sexually assaulted or raped, because that's the culture. Like, how do you deal with that fine line?
I think on the one hand, it depends on the field worker and their just their temperament and their setup of social roles. And so if somebody had asked me, have you ever been sexually harassed in the field, I would probably have said no, because I didn't feel, I got sometimes annoyed, but I never felt threatened physically. So I would just say, no, I have never been harassed. But when you look at the definitions of harassment, then later I have to say, well, actually, I guess I got harassed, that was unwanted behavior. And I think it's really about what type of unwanted behavior do you allow, and that's a pretty fine line. But I think it's just generally discussing and making it clear to your students, watch out, be aware that there is a fine line between something that you can still accept and something that is a real no-go, and start thinking about coping strategies. If it gets to a point where you think that's really not okay, that you are prepared to just stop it somehow. And of course, at some points, I think nobody wants to be raped, so I think oftentimes it may also fail, but I would hope that that would not happen to my students.
Part of preparation could also be finding out which authorities are safe
yes.
to go to.
Yes.
And so in Papua New Guinea, you would not want to go to police necessarily,
yes.
but perhaps in other parts of the world you would go.
Mm-hmm.
But you need to know that.
Yes.
So
we
who
can,
to go to, yes.
Okay, we'll do two more then.
I just want to follow up on this comment that I think it's important to recognize that sexual harassment and sexual assault happens everywhere, including at home.
Yes.
And that, you know, there, what we do need to know is like how to deal with these situations in different cultural contexts.
Yeah.
And then our last question.
I just had a brief comment to follow up on your points. In my personal experience, I was guided to kind of ask the questions and be aware of the cultural practices and my role and women's role there. But then for me, it ended up being a huge stress, and I didn't realize that that was such a stress that I was carrying, that I had to be a model sort of citizen and a model standard of the white person. And so just also telling the students of that potential stress, you know, like it was a stress for me, maybe it's not a stress for other people, but so I just wanted to add that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks.
There's obviously a lot more to talk about, but thank you so much.
Thank you.